Harry Wright rolled over, chewed a bit on a mouthful of dry air and spat it out. Opened one eye to see if it really would open. Opened the other and closed the first. Closed the second, swung his feet onto the floor. Opened them again and stretched. This was a daily occurrence, and the only thing that made it remarkable at all was that he did it on a Wednesday morning, and yesterday was Monday.
HPPodcraft.com.
That is the intro from Theodore Sturgeon's Yesterday Was Monday, a story that really isn't weird fiction, and yet here we are.
Yes, this is pretty much straight up speculative fiction, but just like any social event, I can find a way to make it weird. Because that's what we do here at the H.P. Lovecraft Literary Podcast. I'm Chad Pfeiffer.
And I'm Chris Lackey, and we're here at HPPodcraft.com.
Our reader today is the amazing Jeff C. Carter. He is one of the hosts, you know Jeff.
I do know Jeff.
He is one of the hosts of the Six Demon Bag podcast, where they pull random topics for discussion related to writing, comics, movies, science, all sorts of fun geekery. You can check it out at SixDemonBagPodcast.com. Thanks, Jeff.
I had a collision of worlds moment this week. I was sitting down to watch Star Trek with Rachel, or my other podcast, Rachel Watches Star Trek. It was the episode A Mock Time. That's where Spock goes into heat, basically, and has got to fight or have sex. One of the two things. Okay. Anyway, the writer's name pops up, and it's Theodore Sturgeon.
Wow.
And I said to Rachel, I go, wait, I know that name. I think that's the author of the story we're covering on the H.P. Lovecraft Literary Podcast. And it was. It is.
It's the big crossover event of the year.
It's like when Superman fought a Hulk.
Exactly. This summer, Chris Lackey loses his Sturgeonity. It's all Sturgeon all the time. What do we know about this guy anyway, Theodore Sturgeon?
So Theodore Sturgeon was born in 1918 in Staten Island, New York, was given the name Edward Hamilton Waldo. The name change was because his mother remarried, but it's kind of strange to change the kid's first name too.
Yeah.
And I might be missing something there. I don't understand why he went from Edward Hamilton Waldo to Theodore.
If you know, if you're changing the last name, why not change it all? I mean, if that's the time to do it, if you're going to do it. And that name change happened when he was 11.
Yeah.
He had a full decade as Edward Hamilton Waldo. And also being 11 when he changed his name, I'm surprised that he went with Theodore instead of, you know, Robot Ninja Boss Sturgeon or something. If I got to choose my name when I was 11, I don't know. Would have been something crazy, I think.
I'm just guessing he didn't choose his name, that his new father, his stepfather, changed his first name as well.
Yeah, you look like a Theodore.
My name's Edward. Shut up, Theodore.
I think that's exactly what happened. We just dramatized it.
Oh, poor guy. Theodore, or whatever we're going to call him, sold his first story in 1938, but his first genre story was sold to John W. Campbell in 1939 for Astounding Science Fiction. From then on, he wrote for Astounding Science Fiction, Unknown Magazine, and Argosy Magazine. He only published one story with Campbell after 1950 because of editorial differences. He ghost wrote an Ellery Queen novel. Those are mysteries.
Yeah.
The Player on the Other Side was the name of the book that was published in 1963, which did really well, and he got very high praise for that. And of course, he also wrote for Star Trek. He wrote the episode Shore Leave and then A Mock Time. He's credited for inventing Ponfar and the Live Long and Prosper. That's his.
That's pretty impressive, especially Ponfar, because I think it takes a special kind of creativity to be watching Star Trek and say, you know what we need? A Spock sex episode. You know, it's a smart decision.
Yeah.
That's a great episode, too, actually. I know that one pretty well.
He wrote a few scripts that were never produced, and it is said that he introduced the prime directive in one of his scripts, and then they picked that up later for another story.
Wow.
So this guy's got some sci-fi chops.
Yeah, man.
Probably the highest credentials that he has is that he wrote an episode of The Land of the Lost. That's kind of the apex of all sci-fi.
Absolutely. Yeah. What a show. It looks beautiful.
It sure sure holds up, man.
Yeah.
And of course, he wrote that episode of The New Twilight Zone, which you talked about.
Yeah.
The episode was called A Matter of Minutes, which was inspired by this story.
Yeah. Did he write the teleplay for that as well?
He did not actually write that episode.
Oh, wait. I'm looking at it right now. Right. It was Rockne S. O'Bannon with
some uncredited contributions by good old Harlan Ellison.
I actually rewatched that segment.
Oh, yeah.
From the new Twilight Zone, because that's where I became familiar with the story, as I said in the last episode. But the new Twilight Zone was smart because they'd have a few segments in each episode. Now, if they just had one clever twist or something, it didn't have to get stretched out over a full half hour the way it used to be in the old show,
oh,
you know?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
They could do like a 5-minute segment and then a half hour segment and a 15-minute segment. But this one, a matter of minutes, it's actually available to watch on YouTube. I think it's about 20 minutes long. It's got Adam Arkin in it as the main guy, and then it adds his wife as a character. And it follows the story pretty well. The effects are definitely dated, but I actually still enjoyed it. It held up pretty good. So I recommend people checking that out if they like the story.
Harlan Ellison was somebody that was inspired by Sturgeon's work. Also Bradbury, Samuel R. Delaney. He had a lot of sway over the science fiction writing community.
Yeah.
And he won the World Fantasy Lifetime Achievement Award in 1985. And he's also said to be the inspiration for Kurt Vonnegut's character, Kilgore Trout.
Kilgore Trout, the spectacularly unsuccessful sci-fi author. Apparently, Vonnegut and Sturgeon were pals before either of them were successful.
Oh.
Trout is a play on Sturgeon, right? Both being fish for last names.
Yes.
I think Vonnegut invented Kilgore Trout in interviews I'd read because he wanted to be able to tell the plot of a science fiction story or book without actually having to write it. Like, if he came up with an idea, he didn't want to spit it all out. And I know I've mentioned it before, but my favorite Kilgore Trout story is in Breakfast of Champions.
Yes.
I'll just quote from the book. It says, "As for the story itself, it was entitled The Dancing Fool. Like so many Trout stories, it was about a tragic failure to communicate. Here was the plot. A flying saucer creature named Zog arrived on Earth to explain how wars could be prevented and how cancer could be cured. He brought the information from Margo, a planet where the natives conversed by means of farts and tap dancing. Zog landed at night in Connecticut. He had no sooner touched down than he saw a house on fire. He rushed into the house, farting and tap dancing, warning the people about the terrible danger they were in. The head of the house brained Zog with a golf club."
The end.
The end. He's like, I don't need to write the whole book. Just give you the summary. Apparently, an editor that he had worked with said, you know, the thing with science fiction books is that they always, I love it when people tell me the plots, but I don't actually want to go read them because it's ponderous. I think he agreed, and that's where this Kilgore Trout guy came about.
Theodore Sturgeon died in 1985 while living in Eugene, Oregon.
The Science Fiction and Fantasy Hall of Fame inducted Sturgeon in 2000. He was quite a respected guy.
So let's get into the story. Our protagonist, Harry Wright, wakes up and he knows it's Wednesday, but it's supposed to be Tuesday. He went to sleep Monday night, woke up Wednesday morning. He knows this because he only sleeps 6 hours at most ever, and he couldn't possibly have slept that long.
Somehow he just knows that it's Wednesday. I mean, I guess nowadays your phone would be telling you that it's Wednesday, but this is 1941.
Right.
It's just instinct. It's just some kind of, he goes, it feels very Wednesday-ish, right?
It felt like Wednesday. There was a Wednesday-ish feel in the air.
It says, if he had been the worrying type, he would have started then and there, but he wasn't. He was an easygoing sort, the kind of man that gets himself into a rut and stays there until he is pushed out.
Hmm.
So I don't think rut is a negative thing here. It just means that he's a man of habits that he likes to stick to,
mm-hmm.
a lot like our protagonist from last week's story. And it was that missing that gap, you know, when he's in the story, The Street That Wasn't There. Was that the name of that story last week?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
When he walks down the street and just suddenly a whole block is missing. That was the first thing that reminded me of this, because you wake up and a whole day is missing. It's that same kind of thing. What happened?
Harry is an auto mechanic, and he has been for 8 years, and he probably would be for the rest of his life. He just wants to figure out what happened to Tuesday and get on with his business.
Right.
As he's getting ready for his day, getting dressed and whatnot, he realizes there is something unfinished about his apartment. Nothing he can see specifically. He can't point anything out. There is the smell of cut lumber in the air, a feeling of unfinishedness. So Harry walks out and he sees a 3-foot-tall man working on the step. He's wearing a leather coat and a peaked cap. Harry asks him what he's doing, and the little man says, "Touch up."
Yes, although he's actually using a chisel to put dings in the wood. He's scarring it intentionally.
The little man says, "The actor in the 3rd floor front has a nail in his right heel. He came in late Tuesday night and cut the wood here. I have to get it ready for Wednesday." And then Harry says, "This is Wednesday." And the guy says, "Of course, always has been, always will be." So Harry, he's the kind of guy that really takes things in stride.
Yeah.
But this actor, this saying that the guy upstairs is an actor, bugged him because he's like, he's not an actor. He works on the docks. He goes, "What do you mean by that?" And the little man says, "Oh, they're all actors. All people are actors."
He thinks, "I thought he looked like a regular guy, too." An actor? Actors look like regular guys, too. They're not always handsome.
No.
You know, we need character actors, too. I think this story was a lot more influential on me than I remembered. When I was in college, the first play I ever wrote and produced, it was called Lou is the Only Real Guy.
Oh, yeah?
It was basically The Truman Show, although that movie hadn't come out yet. So that movie ripped me off.
It did.
But in my play, a guy discovers that his life is fake. Everybody are actors. and it's all a show. And I think that Twilight Zone adaptation of this definitely planted some of those seeds early on. I didn't remember it until recently, but it definitely was taking a cue from that.
It's true. And it was a great play. I remember seeing it. It was probably the best play ever written.
I don't know if I agree with that.
I think it was pretty awesome. Maybe not the best play ever written, but definitely one of the best plays ever written.
Sure, okay. I'll take that.
Do you have a copy of that? Like a script laying around anywhere?
I have a script still, yeah.
Yeah, okay.
It's not very good. It's very overwritten. You came and helped out, though, because you came. I was playing a crazy old man in between the scenes, and you came and did my makeup for
me. I did. Yeah, it was my early makeup effects days. Harry thinks that this guy is crazy, so he just goes on his way to work. Now, he thinks about this car that he's working on. It's a 39 sedan with a busted rear spring. Once he gets to work on that baby, he can forget about all this wackiness that's going on.
That's all that matters to a man in a rut. Work, eat, sleep, payday. Why even try to think anything else out? He's one of those guys that's content to have the repetition, to have the routine.
So on his walk, he notices that nothing is moving, and the only people that are about are carbon copies of the little man on the steps, and they're all working on things. And again, the whole town has an unfinished feel to it.
If there were 3-foot-tall guys everywhere, I would be pretty freaked out by it. But surprisingly, Harry's pretty calm.
Yeah, he takes everything in stride, this dude.
Yeah.
So he stops and he looks and he sees that little men are making things look older and dirtier.
Yeah, they're pumping dust onto upholstery, denting bumpers, cracking windshields. It's a lot of work to make things look bad.
He decides, despite the craziness, he's just going to let it go. And he goes on to work. When Harry gets to his garage, he sees that more of these little men are in the shop and they're making things dirtier there too, putting oil and grease on stuff. His boss isn't around and neither are the other mechanics. He lets this go, so he just puts on his coveralls and heads to his car.
Hell with it. I got my job. This ain't none of my affair. That's crazy. I mean, he does come in earlier than everybody else, so it's not totally weird that the other workers aren't there. But all these 3-foot-tall guys are running around rubbing stuff with oil. I mean, that's weird.
When he gets to his car, he sees that one of these little guys is working on his car, the 39 sedan. And this finally pisses him off. And he asks the little guy what he's doing. And the little guy says he's finishing up the spring job. Holding back rage, Harry asks him who told him to do that. To which the little guy says, well, it just has to be done. Then Harry threatens him and gets a bit violent. He says, you get within 6 feet of that car and I'll twist your head off your neck with a Stilson.
Which, that's a big wrench, isn't it?
Oh.
You're right, it's a pretty violent thing to threaten somebody with. I have to say, I was pretty entertained by the dialogue and slang throughout the story.
Oh, yeah.
We don't get a lot of that in the things that we read. There's lots of why I oughta, you know, stuff like that.
Well, he grabs the little guy and the little dude pleads to be released. The little guy says, if I don't leave the car the way it was on Tuesday night, Harry stops him and he says, wait a minute, when was Tuesday night? And the little man says, the last act, of course. Let me go, and I'll call the district supervisor. Harry's still mad at him. He's not going to let him go. So the guy kicks Harry, and then he gets away.
He starts squealing, supervisor, supervisor, emergency!
Harry growled and started after him. But suddenly, in the air between him and the midget workman, a long white hand appeared. The empty air was swept back, showing an aperture from the garage to blank, blind nothingness. Out of it stepped a tall man in a single, loose-fitting garment, literally studded with pockets. The opening closed behind the man. Harry cowered before him. Never in his life had he seen such noble, powerful features, such strength of purpose, such broad shoulders, such a deep chest. The man stood with the backs of his hands on his hips, staring at Harry as if he were something somebody forgot to sweep up.
And they did this in the adaptation, the whole pulling the curtain of reality aside and stepping into nothingness.
Mm-hmm.
Although in that adaptation, the workers are not 3 feet tall. They're just these faceless blue people.
Whoa.
Like they're completely blue. It's like a giant blue man group show is going on. There was no blue man group at the time, but yeah, they've all got like blue ball caps, no faces. It's pretty eerie.
So the little man points Harry out to the beautiful man, saying he's the one. And the guy wants to know who Harry is. And Harry says, the mechanic. The beautiful man says that he's Iridel, the supervisor of the district of Futura.
I wondered if there was any significance to the name Iridel, like if it was biblical or something. I looked around and couldn't find anything.
Yeah, it sounds
like it would be an angel angel's name,
it
right?
It does sound like that, but it's not.
And Harry says to this guy, Iredell, where in hell did you come from? And the guy says, I did not come from hell. I came from Thursday.
So Iredell says that the whole situation is strange. An actor on the stage before it has been built. Unheard of, really. He explains that the little men are stagehands. They're setting the stage for Wednesday, but Tuesday is going on right now. But Harry insists that today is Wednesday. And Iredell says, it is Wednesday. Today is Tuesday. Tuesday is today. Today is simply the name for the stage set which happens to be in use. Yesterday means the set that has just been used. Tomorrow is the set that will be used after the actors have finished with today, which is Wednesday. Yesterday was Monday. Today is Tuesday. See? And Harry says, no.
No.
And he goes, this is Act Wednesday, Scene 622. That means that everything you see around you here is being readied for 622 a.m. on Wednesday. Wednesday isn't a time, it's a place. The actors are moving along towards it. Iredell points the clock out to Harry and it says 622 on the clock, which was the time Harry woke up in the morning. And Iredell explains that no time has passed. Time doesn't pass until the actors actually make their entrance. So Harry uses the analogy that time is a road and people walk on it, but it doesn't change itself. And Iredell takes the analogy a step further and says that he and the little men are building the road ahead of the actors.
Now, in the Twilight Zone adaptation, they compressed this a bit so that it wasn't each day being built, but each minute.
Oh, whoa.
This kind of implies that's the same though, right?
Yeah.
It's like they're building each day, but he says this is 622, like they're going to have a 623 they build and a 624 as well?
Yeah, maybe.
Is it just that it starts once the actors show up, then time starts passing? I don't know.
Yeah, it seems kind of strange, but sure.
It seems like an extraordinary amount of work either way for people who seem to have magical powers. Yeah. So I don't know why they're doing all this actual labor, but
maybe what they're doing is magic and it just manifests the way that Harry sees it as manual labor.
Right, right. That's just the way that he's able to
process
conceive
it.
Of it.
Yes.
Yeah.
I'm just throwing things out there. Anyway, sure. Harry remembers a time when an airplane mechanic told him how flight works. And it has something to do with lift and air currents, but it just went over his head. This is reminding him of that conversation. Harry asks where Tuesday is at, and Iredell says, right over there. And he points. And when he points, his hand disappears.
Right. Like he's pointing at something on the other side of that mystical nothingness or that veil that he'd lifted earlier. His hand does reappear when he brings it back in.
Harry asks him what direction that was that he pointed. And Iredell explains that it's the fourth dimension, duration, time.
They never told me that in school, said Harry.
So Harry asks Iredell about all the actors. Like, why are they doing acting stuff? And Iredell says, well, it's for a play for the amusement of an audience. And Harry says, well, who's the audience? And Iredell says, certain ones who may be amused.
I thought that was pretty cool. Yeah, certain ones. Maybe we're going to approach some weird fiction here. Like, who are these certain ones? Maybe they're elder things who created humans for their amusement, which, you know, came up in Mountains of Madness. But I actually think it's more traditionally religious, right? The story,
yeah.
as it reveals itself, it seems to have kind of a Christian framework.
Well, it does have a religious overtone, but there are some other stuff that doesn't quite fit into that
right
scheme. But let's talk about that at the end.
Okay.
Iredell wants to know how Harry got there, but Harry doesn't know. He just says that he walked over there. Iredell says that Harry will have to go see the producer. Iredell takes Harry on his rounds with him, and a little man comes up and he's got an issue. He says the weather makers put 0.006 of 1% too little moisture on the air on the set. There's 3/70 of an ounce, too little gasoline in the storage tanks over here. And then Iredell says, how much in the tanks? And he says, 4,273 gallons, 3 pints, 7 21/34 ounces. Iredell grunted, let's let it go this time. That was very sloppy work. Someone's going to get transferred to limbo for this.
There it is, limbo, which is also very Catholic
yes.
sounding. And they've already referenced hell, so these concepts are coming out. But when explaining how all this works in the adaptation, for the Twilight Zone guy, this character is like, have you ever been looking for your keys and you can't find them? But then you come back and there they are right where you thought you left them. That's because of these little mistakes that they make here and there. Where, you know, one of the stagehands forgot to place them, but then went back and did it for the following minute, which is why they disappeared and reappeared. I remember hearing that and going, wow, man. That makes a lot of sense. I lose sunglasses like that all the time.
You're young, impressionable, mind Pfeiffer.
Yeah.
Iredell points out to Harry that the actors aren't good at covering up mistakes. In fact, they go way off script if they find mistakes.
Right.
As Iredell's talking, Harry notices an empty lot with strange bare patch of vegetation missing. Iredell says that the actors won't go that way, so they don't need to finish it. And Harry asks, well, what if they do? And Iredell says that's what the prompters are for. GAs, as he calls them, which is short for Guardian Angels. They get people back on script.
Yeah, this was also in the adaptation. There was an alleyway or something in the city that didn't get built out because they just knew nobody was going to go down there in that minute. Mm-hmm. So there is a script, which I guess means we're all predestined to do things and there's no free will or very limited free will.
Yeah, I guess
they know
so.
Exactly what's going to happen every day and every year.
Well, there is no free will, Pfeiffer, so.
Oh, okay.
Just deal with that.
Thank God there's Free Willy.
Thank God. Iredell says that it all looks good there, so they're going to move on to Friday. And Harry's surprised they're already working on Friday.
Yeah, Iredell says, of course, we work years in advance.
So Iredell opens a gateway, which freaks Harry out a bit, but eventually Harry walks through it and it's fine.
He found himself in a great round chamber whose roundness was touched a bit with the indistinct. That is, it had curved walls and a domed roof, but there was something else about it. It seemed to stretch off in that direction toward which Iredell had so astonishingly pointed. The walls were lined with an amazing array of control machinery. Switches and ground glass screens, indicators and dials, knobs and levers. Moving deftly before them was a crew of men, each looking exactly like Iredell, except that their garments had no pockets. Harry stood wide-eyed, hypnotized by the enormous complexity of the controls and the ease with which the men worked among them. Iredell touched his shoulder. Come with me, he said. The producer is in now. We'll find out what is to be done with you.
So Iredell takes him to a great bronze door that is polished so much that it's see-through. I don't know what that means exactly, but that's what it says. But then he realizes the door is closing and Harry is on the other side of it. So now Harry finds himself in a very small room with a huge desk, and the man behind the desks asks him, where'd you blow in from? The voice is described as sounding like the angry bee sound of an approaching hurricane.
Okay, is that what that sounds like? An angry bee?
Well, I know that approaching tornadoes have kind of almost like a locomotive sound. Like they sound like it's like a train coming, which could kind of sound like angry bees, maybe? I don't know.
What if an angry bee's hijacked a train, for sure?
Definitely. So Harry asks if he's the producer. The guy, not answering the question, he seems surprised to see Harry, and then he begins complaining about actors. Building houses for me that I can almost never go into, getting together and sending requests for better parts, listening carefully to what I have to say and then ignoring or misinterpreting my advice, always asking for just one more chance, and when they get it, messing that up too, and now one of you crashes the gate.
So this is God?
Yeah, it sure sounds like it.
When he says building houses for me, he's talking about churches, I assume.
Yes.
And then that people are always asking for just one more chance, and then when they get it, messing that up.
Yeah.
Sounds like people are praying to him.
Yeah. So the producer is God.
I think.
We think. Harry tells him he wants to get back to Tuesday, to which the producer says, oh, you want a favor? He complains a bit, and then he says, okay, sure. Then Harry's back outside of the door. Iredell asks what the producer said, and Harry says to send him back. He asks if Monday night is good, and Harry says, yeah, sure.
But that was confusing to me. Why did he send him back to Monday night if today is Tuesday, and that's where he needs to actually end up?
Yeah.
So when I thought it was just a mistake, but then when I was rereading it, Iredell specifically says, okay, I'm going to send you to Monday night.
Yeah, 9:30 p.m.
He turned to ask Iredell if this would enable him to go to bed again and do Tuesday right from the start, but Iredell was gone. Suddenly he's back in Monday night.
He finds himself in the garage, but it's all bright and the clock says it's 9:30. Also, there are little men all around, but these little men are different. They look tired and they weren't building things. They were taking things apart.
As the Wednesday crews worked, so the Monday gangs slaved. And the work they were doing was different. For here they were breaking down, breaking up, carting away. Also, there are overseers who are whipping these little guys and they fall behind. So this isn't a good work situation. And I think this is the limbo that was referred to.
Yes.
Earlier.
So this creeps Harry out. So he screams for Iredell, but this other guy shows up, angry as sin. He says, what makes you think you're going to find Iredell in limbo? And then he asks Harry who he is, and Harry explains.
Limbo is just like old days that are getting recycled. It's not the edge of hell or anything like that, but the work is tough. But Harry knows the lingo now, and he tells this guy, well, I'm an actor.
So the guy doesn't believe him, says that nobody ends up in limbo by mistake, and he starts to manhandle Harry to get him to tell him why he's there.
Yeah, he's choking him.
The guy says his name is Gura, and he's the supervisor of Limbo, and he's a rough and tumble badass.
Yeah.
Harry didn't like the way that Gura is grabbing him and getting into his face, so he freaking clocks Gura right in the chops, knocking him down.
Yeah.
So Gura is surprised more than angry, and then he laughs and he says he likes Harry's spunk.
Hey, he said, suddenly friendly, you're all right. Took a poke at me, didn't you? Be damned, first time in a month of Mondays anyone ever made a pass at me. Last was a feller named Orton. I killed him.
Now, by the way, this whole, like, I like his spunk thing, that never happened in real life. That's just not, that never, ever happens. Some dude, you punch him, he gets really angry, and then he really beats the crap out of you. That's what happens.
I tried it when I was a little kid, and I'd get beat up. I'd be like, hey, I like your spunk. Hoping that they would stop beating me.
No, you've misinterpreted. The bully is the one that you punch, and then the bully says, hey, I like your spunk, kid. You stood up to me. I respect that. Never happens.
No.
So that's a fabrication and fiction that has been perpetuated for years. I don't know why. Gura explains that they have to take down the old sets and recycle what they can and scrap the rest. It's the crap job of the other world.
Yeah.
Gura has Harry explain in detail what happened. He does. He tells Gura about Iridel and the producer and how Iridel was supposed to get him back to the stage with the actors. And Gura busts up laughing. Iridel made a mistake. And Gura is going to use this to blackmail him for the rest of eternity.
Which is so confusing to me because it didn't seem like a mistake. It seemed like he did that intentionally. But Gura is pretty happy about it.
Yeah.
He says, I got old Iridel by the short hair. No more busted backs. No more snotty messages. Ha, ha, ha. He's telling the workers they can cool off a little bit. They don't have to slave so hard.
Gura gets on the phone and he calls Iridel.
Right. Well, it's pretty weird what he does. He shouts, telephone. And then two of his little workers hustle over. One jumps up on his right shoulder and the other on his left with his head forward. And so the guy on his left shoulder, he yells into his ear, give me Iridel. And then the other guy on his other shoulder starts speaking in Iridel's voice. Well, so it's like the two guys together made a phone for him somehow.
Bizarre.
It's very bizarre. Gura says, hi, you fancy pants.
Iridel is all indignant at first, but he quickly realizes his error and tries to butter up Gura.
He says, look, let's talk this thing over. About that shipment of three-legged dogs I was wanting you to round up for me. I guess I can do without them. What's that all about? What does he need this shipment of three-legged dogs for?
Why does he need them? But then why can he do without them, too? What kind of story was he writing here where somehow there's a bunch of three-legged dogs, but now he's like, well, you know what? I could ride around the three-legged dogs.
Yeah, what's going on?
I want more of that.
I want that story, yeah.
Anyway, Gura has Iridel over a barrel.
Gura knocked the two small heads together, breaking the connection and probably the heads. That's how he hangs up. He turns grinning to Harry and says, Iridel never forgives anyone and he never forgets a slip. He's the cause of half the misery back here with his hurry-up orders. Now things are going to be different. The boss has wanted me to give Iridel a dose of his own medicine for a long time now, but Eerie never gave him a chance. So I'm assuming the boss is the devil?
Yes, so?
I think so.
Gura tells Harry that he can get him back, but it's 11:30 a.m., so he'll have to make up his own excuses for why he's late at work. Mm-hmm. Gura thanks Harry and says that if he's ever in limbo, to look him up and he'll give him a real sweet job.
Yeah, he's basically saying after you're dead, if you don't like it in heaven too much, you can kick it with us in hell, which there probably are a lot more interesting people in hell. So it might not be a bad choice. Yeah. And then we conclude the story.
Holding his breath, Harry Wright stepped through the doorway. He had to walk 30 blocks to the garage, and when he got there, the boss was waiting for him. Where you been, Wright? I lost my way. Don't get wise. What do you think this is? Vacation time? Get going on the spring job. Damn it. It won't be finished now till tomorrow. Harry looked him straight in the eye and said, listen, it'll be finished tonight. I happen to know. And, still grinning, he went back into the garage and took out his tools.
And then that's the end of the story.
That's the end of the story, yeah.
So, what did you think?
It was cute.
Yeah, it was pretty mind-blowing to me when I was young, but now not so much. I think that maybe we read so many interesting, complicated things that this was just a little like, oh, I get it. You know, yeah. I mean, I got it right away. I kind of knew what it was going in, but then it just, I didn't expect this kind of heaven-hell thing played over it.
No, I didn't expect that either.
That seemed odd because to me, the thing that I thought was so neat when I saw the show was just that just as with the other things that we've been reading this month, you know, there's something happening that we, you know, it's right there under our noses, but we don't see it. That was really the concept that hooked me.
Right.
There's this whole other world there. But yeah, I still enjoy the story. It was a fun little read.
What I did think is interesting and possibly weird is the audience, the people that are actually watching the show, because the producer is God. So God's not watching the show.
Right.
We've got the devil working in limbo and he's the boss. The people aren't watching the show. So what are the certain others?
Yeah, I don't know. I think must be some kind of great old ones or elder things or something.
Could be.
It's the only thing that makes sense to me.
It is the only thing that makes sense to me. One of the things that also doesn't make any sense to me are all the people that support us on Patreon.
Those are the certain audience members that we have.
Yes.
But I am glad that they're doing it.
I want to thank some of these members that have signed up with us and become part of our team, the HP Podcraft Rock and Roll team.
That's right. That's what it's called.
I just named it that. That's what it is now.
Yeah.
So I like it. I want to thank Eric Ann.
I want to thank Ben Auerbach.
Rafe Ball.
William Bragg.
I want to thank Matt Hirt.
Matty Hilker.
Roberto Lemus.
Eldritch Scary.
Eric Espalone, MD.
Hey, we got a doctor listening. Curtis Y. Takahashi. Thank you so much for your support.
All of you Patreon supporters out there, kick ass. Chad and I couldn't be more thrilled with your participation. And hopefully you're enjoying the extra content, the comment show, and our bonus show, which will be coming out soon.
We have been casting around for topics, and I think we're going to talk about Marvel Comics. We don't really get to talk about comic books very much on the show. So we thought we'd dig into Lovecraftian influences in Marvel. And, you know, we might do some Marvel versus DC comparisons. Nothing thorough, but we'll just be geeking it up on that one.
Yeah.
So yeah, that'll be a good time. I hope that folks will tune into that. July, our first free show is going to be on the Michael Shea story, Dagoniad.
Yes.
And that's going to be the return of our friend Patton Oswalt on that one. So I hope you will tune in to listen to Patton's thoughts on that. But that's all we have for this week. I'm Chad Pfeiffer.
I'm Chris Lackey, and you've been listening to the H.P. Lovecraft Literary Podcast
at hppodcraft.com.
hppodcraft.com.